from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Here are some sobering facts for you. More women than men die annually from heart disease. Some heart attacks occur without the symptom we all think of, sudden chest pain. And lots of things can lead to congestive heart failure, from a fatty diet to a lack of sleep, or even too much sleep. But researchers are closer to developing a test that would predict a heart attack. And new drugs, including a medication traditionally used for diabetes, are showing promise in preventing heart disease. Today on the program, we're talking with two local experts about the heart and about new findings in heart health. Plus, details of the North Temple makeover. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Hearts represent love, affection, and the center of one's emotional core. But symbolic meanings aside, the heart is a very powerful organ, the pump that circulates blood and is essential for our survival. Today on the program, we're learning more about this vital organ and what the latest research is revealing about indicators of heart trouble, new treatments, and medications that are showing promise. Joining me this hour is Dr. Brent Wilson. He is director of the Cardiovascular Center and the Echo Laboratory at the University of Utah. He's also an investigator at the Comprehensive Arrhythmia Research and Management Center, CARMA, at the U, and he joins me in studio. Dr. Wilson, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Also with us, Dr. Brent Muehlstein, both Brents here in the studio today, a cardiovascular researcher at the Heart Institute at Intermountain Medical Center in Murray. He serves on the editorial boards of the American Heart Journal, the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, and the Journal of Interventional Cardiology. And Dr. Muehlstein, good morning to you.
Good morning, and thanks for inviting me here.
Later on in the program, an update on the North Temple Corridor, but first, the heart. What do you want to know about how your heart works? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Wilson, I want to start with you. Introduce us to the heart. Tell us just a little bit about this vital organ.
Well, Jennifer, it's of essential importance. The heart, it's the means by which blood circulates through the lungs to pick up oxygen, and then that oxygen-rich blood is then pumped by the heart to the various organs in the body, which sustains life. So the heart is essential, of course, to life. It's one of our most important organs.
Why did you specialize in cardiology?
That's a great question, and that is something that evolved over many years. And Dr. Muehlstein and I were just actually talking about his son, who was also interested in cardiology. But when I went to medical school in California, cardiology was just something that held a special interest to me, and I gravitated toward that area, and it's something that I enjoy doing very much.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Muehlstein, why did you fall in love with the heart?
That's also an interesting pathway. It started because during the second year of medical school, we learned what are called organ systems courses, and they go through the various different organ systems, the neurologic organ system, the gastrointestinal organ system, the bone organ system, etc. And when we went to the cardiovascular organ system, it was just such a fascinating thing to study, and I've been interested in it ever since that. So second year in medical school is when the decision was made.
Fascinating. What's the fascination for the about the heart for you?
It is interesting. The way that came about is we had the opportunity to do an experiment in an open chest dog experiment, which was done very kindly and in a nice way. And I appreciate the contribution of the dog to let me do that experiment. But we watched the heart, and then we could make various different sorts of manipulations of the heart. We would stimulate the vagus nerve, which is a nerve that goes to the heart and could slow the heart down, way down, and then we would stimulate the sympathetic nerve and watch the heart speed up, and we could watch the blood pressure go up and down based on various manipulations. And then we could follow it and evaluate just exactly on a beat-to-beat basis changes that happen in the heart. And the fact that the heart is so responsive to any sort of external stimulus and that you start exercising and the heart suddenly speeds up. How does the heart know to speed up once you start to exercise? All those sorts of physiologic things about the heart just made it fascinating for me, and I'm still fascinated by it.
Hmm. Lots of mysteries there. What are some of the common complaints that you hear from your patients? You've both been in practice for many years now. What are some of the things about the heart that we have learned in recent research and what we're still hoping to learn? Dr. Muhlstein.
Well, it turns out that perhaps because the heart is so essential to life, the heart and its problems turn out to be the major cause of death for more than half of all of us in the United States and all throughout the whole world. And because if the heart doesn't work, the person doesn't survive. And there's this one little problem called atherosclerosis, which is the buildup of cholesterol plaque inside the arteries that go right off the heart and back into the heart to feed it blood. And they build up with cholesterol blockage. And then when they totally block, the heart gets no blood flow, and that part of the heart muscle dies. That's called a heart attack. And because of this simple little problem of heart attacks that affect such a small portion of the little part of the arteries that go to the heart, it ends up being the cause of more than half the deaths in all the United States.
I was surprised to see that there is still one death every 39 seconds due to heart disease. And yet heart disease has really declined. Death from heart disease has declined 30% from 1998 to 2008. Dr. Brent Wilson, are we getting smarter when it comes to keeping our hearts healthy?
We actually are, Jennifer, and some of the new technologies that are emerging, in particular with our ability to move beyond a risk factor-only based approach and some new techniques we have to image the actual disease itself. And I wanted to point out just what Dr. Muhlstein, and to emphasize what he said, that the heart disease is of such a magnitude that it's the number one killer of both men and women in the United States. And many times we think of this as a male disease, but it's really not. It's a female disease. And it's interesting to note that every year since 1984, more women than men have died from cardiovascular disease. And the numbers are staggering. If you look at the number of women each year who die from cardiovascular disease in the United States, it's about 420,000. And if you look at the number of women who die from breast cancer, it's about 40,000 per year.
Hmm.
And so, you know, my wife, my mother, all of the females I know are very aware that they should do breast cancer screening. But I haven't heard very many women say, boy, I need to get a coronary calcium score. I need to look closer into this.
Why? What's going on here? Is it just a perception problem that it's this overweight, middle-aged man who's clutching his chest that women don't identify with? What is it?
I think that's a big part of it. I think when we look at males and we think, boy, that's a male disease, when actually it's not. And women can present with a variety of symptoms which are mistaken for long periods of time. And unfortunately, many people present as their first sign that there might be a problem with sudden death. And so many of these things combine to make it difficult to do some of these preventative measures. But in this area of prevention is one of the areas where we've made the greatest progress in recent years, enabling us to do things like image the coronary arteries non-invasively, allowing us to identify a disease process many years before it causes symptoms or many years before it results in a heart attack or other serious problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Brent Wilson, director of the Cardiovascular Center and Echo Lab at the University of Utah. Also with us, Dr. Brent Muhlstein, a cardiovascular researcher at the Heart Institute at Intermountain Medical Center in Murray. And we're taking your calls. If you have questions or comments about the heart, if you have a heart condition, if you want to learn something more about the heart and new treatment options, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. As Dr. Wilson explained, more women are dying from heart disease than men. What else makes one vulnerable to heart disease? What about the genes, the genetic makeup of somebody? Is that a determining factor in who gets heart disease? Dr. Muhlstein?
It certainly is. We've been studying heart disease for a long time, and it first started with the Framingham study, which started back in 1947. And studies from that and have been expanded extensively since that time come up with five classic risk factors that are associated with having heart disease and then dying from it. One of those is family history, which is another name for genetics. Another one is diabetes. Another one is smoking. Another one is high blood pressure. And then the final one is high cholesterol. And so those are the five prime risk factors that we know about associated with heart disease. And one interesting thing to follow up with the story about women, perhaps one reason why women don't think about heart disease as being the major way they're going to die is because women do get some protection before they reach menopause because of their female hormone status, and they have less heart disease than men. When they're younger. Mm-hmm. Once they reach menopause, though, then they very quickly catch up with men. But breast cancer oftentimes happens in younger women, and therefore it seems to be more apparent. Although most older women still don't want to die from a heart attack if they can stop it. And that's the critical point about it. The thing that Dr. Wilson was talking about, we have over the past many years developed ways to take care of a patient once they get heart disease, but sometimes it just doesn't work very well. If you have a massive heart attack and you happen to be in a place where you can't get instantaneous care, you might just die. And one third of patients who die from heart attacks, that heart attack is their first presenting symptom, and so they die before they ever reach the hospital, before they even knew they had the trouble. So that emphasizes the importance of screening and doing early preventative treatments. And so that if a woman doesn't want to die from a heart attack when she turns 75, when she's 40 is the time, or 35 is the time to start thinking about, what do I need to do now to make sure I don't have a heart attack then? And that's the same for men and women. And so under those circumstances, a woman should say, yes, my risk of dying is just as much as a man, even if I'm going to die a little later if I don't do anything. But I have the ability to do something right now to prevent me from dying from a heart attack when I'm 70.
So, you know, you can't do anything about who you're born to and who you are genetically, but there are a lot of behavioral factors. You mentioned one of them was smoking. How does smoking affect a heart, just physically? What's going on there physiologically?
Now, smoking does a variety of things. One is because of the nicotine, it increases your blood pressure. Also, there's all these different aerosolized products that are sort of like very concentrated air pollution, and you breathe them directly into your lungs, and they basically damage the vessels so that the cholesterol everybody has some cholesterol in their bloodstream, and when you have these toxic things that damage the endothelial lining of the coronary arteries and other arteries in the body and allow the cholesterol to build up, which then will ultimately totally plug the artery and cause a heart attack.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Brent Muehlstein with Intermountain Medical Center at the Heart Institute there. Also, Dr. Brent Wilson, director of the Cardiovascular Center at the University of Utah. We're talking about heart and heart health. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones, and Rob is joining us from Salt Lake City. Rob, hi.
Hi. I'm 37 years old. I'm pretty active and hope to remain so as possible. I lost a dad to a massive heart attack, and I've had an uncle have a quadruple bypass, and I love meat. So my plan, my hope is to avoid heart disease, avoid a lifetime of medicating myself, and to avoid vegetarianism. And currently I'm using Weight Watchers to kind of map that out and keep myself in line. And I was just wondering what your panel had to say about that plan.
Interesting question, Rob. The question of diet. Rob wants to maintain his carnivorous status. Dr. Brent Wilson, is that feasible? And can you have a healthy heart and eat meat as well?
Jennifer, you absolutely can. But I think an important thing to keep in mind is moderation. If people would like to eat red meat every meal, that's probably not the best thing to do. I think a problem with consuming meat or over-consuming probably just about anything is obesity. And Rob mentioned his emphasis on his weight and going to Weight Watchers and keeping that under control. That certainly is an issue that is becoming more and more of a problem for Americans, with 67% of us being overweight and half of those people being obese. And with all of the accompanying problems that come along with obesity, makes it harder to exercise. And in terms of the heart, we set fairly aggressive goals for exercise. We'd like you to be active, moderate intensity exercise performed on at least 5 days of the week for at least 30 minutes. And that's kind of our lower limits for the goals we like to set. So I think as long as you moderate the consumption of red meat, I would try to keep that to a minimum as much as possible. Certainly make sure that your diet is balanced, that there are plenty of the other food groups involved, particularly vegetables. I know Dr. Mealstein likes to eat vegetables, so that's why I make sure to point that out. But if you have a balanced approach, just about anything can be healthy.
Dr. Mealstein, anything to add for Rob there?
That is interesting that you'll find all sorts of advocates for various different sorts of diets. But when they've actually studied the diets, the major point about any diet is if you actually reduce your weight. And so it's not eating that's bad. It's being obese that's bad. And so any sort of a diet that is successful in keeping you thin and trim will about provide the same sort of levels of cardiovascular health. And so whatever you can do to stay skinny, do it. And exercise, as Dr. Wilson emphasized, is a critical component of a successful, long-standing, heart-healthy lifestyle.
Rob, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We're talking about the heart and heart health with Dr. Brent Wilson from the University of Utah and Dr. Brent Mealstein from Intermountain Medical Center. If you'd like to join us again, 801-355-TALK. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today on the program, we're getting an insider's guide to the heart, how to keep your ticker ticking, and new ways to combat heart disease. With us this hour, Dr. Brent Wilson, director of the Cardiovascular Center at the Echo Lab at the University of Utah, and Dr. Brent Mealstein, a cardiovascular expert at the Heart Institute at Intermountain Medical Center in Murray. And we're taking your calls. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. What do you want to know about the heart and ways to prevent heart disease? I want to get to some of the other behavioral risk factors when it comes to heart disease. What about stress? We hear a lot about, you know, people who are feeling a lot of stress due to busy scheduling and competing interests in their lives. How does stress contribute to stress on the heart? Dr. Mealstein?
Yeah, stress is an interesting sort of a finding, and it certainly does have an effect. And a variety of different studies have been done, one that proposes that a type A personality, which is one who takes things extremely seriously and has to have everything punctual and everything, and when it's not that way, it becomes stressful to them, are associated with more incidence of heart disease. In general, what stress does is it causes a stress response in the body, which is associated with the sympathetic nervous system, increases the amount of adrenaline and so forth. Those sorts of things can increase blood pressure. They can increase your heart rate. And in the end, can be associated with increased complications associated with heart disease. It should be important to remember, however, that it's the stress that the person perceives rather than a certain sort of a lifestyle. So some lifestyles might be considered stressful to some people, but other people thrive on it and they feel good about it. And so if they don't sense the stress, even though they have a very busy life and even have to make lots of decisions that one person might consider to be extremely stressful, for instance, talking on the radio might be very stressful to some people, might be very enjoyable and relaxing to someone else. And so it's not the specific sort of a lifestyle that becomes stressed. But if that, whatever the lifestyle is stressful to the person, it can increase your risk of cardiovascular complications. The brain and the body certainly do go together a lot.
What about alcohol? I understand that, drinking can increase the stress on a heart. But on the flip side, a glass of wine is being shown to have some potential benefits for the heart. Dr. Wilson, where does alcohol fit into the whole heart equation?
That's a great question, Jennifer. It's one that patients often ask in clinic. And, you know, Dr. Milstein is asking me if he can have a glass of wine right now because he thinks there might be some protective effects from
relaxing.
That.
Relaxing, yeah.
And so it does come back to that question of moderation. I think just if we consume too much red meat, certainly if we consume too much alcohol, that can be a bad thing for the heart. Oftentimes we'll see in the hospital alcohol-induced cardiomyopathies where the heart actually loses a significant amount of its functioning because of and related directly to the alcohol intake. So I think it's something we've discussed over long periods of time, and it's probably going to be alcohol in small amounts. When we're talking about that protective effect.
Mm. One item of heart interest that's been in the news is former Vice President Dick Cheney's recent heart transplant stirred up a lot of conversation about transplant issues. First of all, how many heart transplants are done in Utah annually? Dr. Brent Wilson.
That's a great question, and I'd have to talk to my colleagues to get the exact number, but it's around 50.
Okay.
So around 50 or so hearts, and it's a very complicated procedure. And Vice President Cheney took advantage of some of the new advances that have been made over the last several years, in that he had a left ventricular assist device, kind of an external. It's a machine that helped to take over some of the pumping function for his heart. As options were discussed and treatment plans were made, so that he could eventually receive a heart transplantation. And so that's one of the newer tools that we have that allow people with poorly functioning hearts to continue to function with somewhat normal lives, when in fact their heart's not working very well.
Dr. Milstein, how do you decide who gets a heart transplant? What are the factors that go into that decision?
That's a very important question because there are a limited number of hearts to be given. And as we've become more healthy and getting people, motorcycle riders, to wear their helmets and people to have cars with airbags and so forth, the number of traumatic deaths, which is the most common way that a heart transplant becomes a heart donor heart becomes available, have reduced, and therefore we don't have an infinite number of donor hearts to offer, and therefore they have to do it very carefully. And the guidelines that they've set up are based around the most appropriate decision, which is which patients are most likely to benefit the best from this heart. And so that's how all the decisions are made. Some of the decisions based on that have found that in general, patients over the age of 65 won't do as well with a heart transplant as somebody who's under 65, and so 65 is a general cutoff for it. Also,
Vice President's 71, so is he an outlier? Is that kind of unusual to transplant to someone of that age?
Yes, I think he was an outlier, and there may be all sorts of reasons for that. But in general, 65 is sort of the average cutoff, and then, depending on how badly you need it, if you're about to die, then you're more likely to get it than if you're still kind of sick and you could benefit from it, but it would be nice, but you can still survive for a while. So therefore, how severely ill the patient is will put them on a different level of the heart transplant list. Also, other parts of your body, whether the rest of your body is healthy or not, and therefore, if you just fix the heart, well, you basically be kind of back to normal. That's another decision process that's made. Whereas if your kidneys are almost gone and your lungs are almost gone and you have all sorts of multi-organ damage, then if you still just fix the heart, you're still a very sick person, and so that you won't get as much benefit from the heart. Other ways they look at it is, will the heart actually work? And some people who have what are called pulmonary hypertension, if you transplant the heart, it won't work in that person because the right side, which is in a person, the transplant donor didn't have pulmonary hypertension, and so their right heart is not strong enough, hasn't built up enough strength, and so they'll just fail when it happens. And so a whole set of sorts of things. And another final important thing is if you get a heart transplant, it's going to require tremendous follow-up time after time after time, and you have to get biopsied, and you have to see your doctor almost on a weekly basis for a long time. And for the rest of your life, you have to be linked directly and do what the heart transplant doctors tell you, or your heart transplant will fail. And so you have to have a social sort of a circumstance where you're able to demonstrate that you're going to be able to follow all the rules and systems. Otherwise, the heart transplant will fail. It won't do any good, and somebody else will not have gotten that benefit. Hmm. And then the final thing is somebody has to pay for it. And so they have to figure out whether or not this person, through their insurance or whatever system, is going to be able to pay for the heart transplant. And all those things take a big part in deciding who and when someone gets a heart transplant.
Hmm. The heart transplant does seem like the major operation. You know, I mean, it's a drastic measure. I'm sure that there are interventions that aren't quite as drastic. I'm talking about a pacemaker. Do we still do that?
We do.
What other kinds of operations are options for people who have hearts or parts of our heart that are failing? Dr. Brent Wilson.
Thank you, Jennifer. And that's a good thing to point out, that heart transplantation is the ultimate treatment for cardiovascular disease. And a major goal of ours is to detect and do things much, much sooner than that, so that we eliminate the need for heart transplantation. And that can be things as simple as treating your blood pressure, you know, with an ideal blood pressure being less than 120 over 80. It can be something as simple as getting your cholesterol checked, so that if you have a markedly elevated cholesterol, you find out about that early. And if there is evidence of beginning or progressing heart disease, that you do something as simple as take an important medication called a statin and perhaps an aspirin. And then as we progress along things, if you recognize symptoms, which you're more likely to do if you exercise because you're pushing yourself and you're causing your heart to work harder than it would if you were sedentary. So if you begin to develop any symptoms such as chest pain, shortness of breath, lightheadedness, if you get these symptoms with exercise, we can do stress tests. We can do some of our newer, very, very sophisticated and excellent imaging techniques to image the coronary arteries. And if we find a blockage, we can continue treating with medications, or we can place an intracoronary stent. There has been a tremendous advance in the area of stents over the last several years, such that has become a very safe and a very durable solution for the blockages that many people have. And then depending if you have other cardiovascular disease, maybe your heart rate is too slow or that you have a conduction problem. In those cases, patients might benefit from pacemakers. So there are many, many treatment options that are far short of heart transplantation that would benefit the vast majority of people with cardiovascular disease. And our ultimate goal would be to detect this very early, and it would be to move towards the prevention side of things, to catch people before that disease progresses to the point where they would even need something like a stent. Mm-hmm. And that would be our goal, is to cure heart disease in that manner, so that with very small things, exercising, watching your cholesterol, not smoking. It's important to emphasize how important that is not to smoke. By doing some of these simpler things that are very cost-effective, that we can prevent very expensive procedures down the road.
What about some other simple things like taking aspirin a day or vitamin E? Have any of these that we've heard about, do any of these show effectiveness when it comes to preventing heart disease? Dr. Muhlstein?
That's a very interesting question. What sort of medications can we take and as a primary prevention thing? And there are some things that have been proven to be effective, some that have been proven to be ineffective, but maybe benign, and some things that may even actually be a little bit harmful. And it's a really complicated sort of a thing. So I can address some of those. You asked about aspirin.
Mm-hmm.
Aspirin, it turns out, aspirin works by thinning the blood so that if the plaque, cholesterol plaque in the artery ruptures, which then exposes the blood to the clot-forming material inside the plaque, then a clot will form. If you're on aspirin, then it will thin your blood to the point, because it blocks the effect of the platelets, that then you won't clot and you won't totally block the artery and you won't have a heart attack. So aspirin is a third-line sort of a prevention. If you haven't prevented the plaque from growing, if you haven't prevented the plaque from rupturing, at least you can prevent the clot from forming by taking aspirin.
Hmm.
So with that sort of understanding about aspirin, the people that benefit from aspirin are the patients who have plaque that might rupture. And the major area is patients who already have known heart disease. So if you have known heart disease, if you've already had one heart attack, then aspirin absolutely is critical. Now, what about if you never had a heart attack, but you don't ever want to have a heart attack? There's a little bit of a difference. The studies, they've done randomized trials in women with primary prevention, no previous known heart disease, and aspirin actually didn't help.
Hmm.
And aspirin thins your blood and increases the chance of you having a hemorrhage in your brain. And so The guidelines now don't recommend that women take aspirin for primary prevention. Now, women ultimately get heart attacks, we talked about, and once they get one or have known heart disease, then aspirin is just as good for them as it is for men. On the other hand, high-risk men over the age of 35 may benefit from taking aspirin because they're already the ones who are most likely to have existing plaque. So that's the story about aspirin. Now, vitamin E, which is supposedly an antioxidant, vitamin E has been tested in many randomized trials and doesn't hurt and doesn't help in the relation to heart disease. So you can take vitamin E if you want, but it's not going to prevent you from a heart attack.
Okay.
Other areas are folic acid was thought to be good, especially if you have elevated homocysteine, homocysteine is a risk factor for heart disease, but if you take folic acid, it lowers your homocysteine, but it does not lower your risk of a heart attack, and so folic acid doesn't work. Another one is the idea that women should take hormone replacement therapy. We know they're protected before they reach menopause, so why not just replace their hormones after menopause, and then they'll be protected forever? It certainly made sense. And observational studies seem to confirm it, that women who took hormone replacement therapy were less likely to have a heart attack. But there's a special sort of a woman who worries enough about her heart to take hormone replacement therapy if it's felt to be beneficial. And so she does lots of other good things as well. Mm. And it turns out it was all the other good things that she did that made a part. And so when they finally did a randomized trial in which they gave all women, half got it and half didn't get it, so you took out the confounding, it turns out it made no difference at all. So as to which medicines to take and which nutritional supplements to take, you just have to wait and listen and learn the studies and then talk to your doctor, and your doctor will tell you which things actually work and which things might work and which things actually don't work and might hurt you, and then get it all figured out and do what you think is best.
No simple answers out there, are there? Our time is short, but finally, Dr. Brent Wilson, I just want to ask you what's the best advice that you can give to people out there who are concerned? They have a family history of some heart issues. What's some good advice to leave with them today?
Jennifer, this would be advice that I'd give to everyone out there, and that is to first be aware of the symptoms and the warning signs of heart disease, in particular chest pain, shortness of breath, lightheadedness with exercise. Also to be aware of things as your cholesterol value, your blood pressure, and to be physically active, and above all, not to smoke. If we can do these simple things up front, it could prevent, in many cases, a lifetime of problems with cardiovascular disease.
Dr. Brent Wilson, Director of the Cardiovascular Center and Echo Lab at the University of Utah. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dr. Brent Muehlstein, cardiovascular researcher at the Heart Institute at Intermountain Medical Center in Murray. And Dr. Muehlstein, it's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Up next, we're going to turn to North Temple and revamping North Temple. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Salt Lake City residents and business owners have been waiting for a new and improved North Temple corridor for years, and now the dream is becoming reality. Today on the program, we're hearing more about the North Temple project, how a new airport tracks line and other amenities will upgrade life for the businesses and the residents of the city's west side. Joining me for this segment is Frank Gray. He is Salt Lake City's Director of Community and Economic Development. He's in studio. Frank, nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Dave Galvan, he is a member of the Westside Business Alliance and longtime resident of the North Temple area. He's in studio as well. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
There is a public meeting tomorrow about the new North Temple corridor. That's being held tomorrow from 8 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Grand Hall at the Utah Fair Park here in Salt Lake City. There's more detail on our website, kcpw.org. But if you have questions or comments about the North Temple corridor, if you live in the area, if you want to know the status of progress, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. North Temple has been torn up for some time, but the end is in sight. Before we get to the specific improvements, Frank Gray, why focus on North Temple? What's the city's interest in improving this area?
North Temple for years has served as the entrance to our community. With the advent of the freeways, that diminished. We saw a lot of disinvestment going on, a lot of stressed properties, and the neighborhood out there deserves better. We now have the opportunity with the light rail to go to the airport from the downtown area and from the university. There's a tremendous opportunity here to see that revitalization occur and services again provided to the community in their local community area.
Dave Galvan, you are part of the West Side Business Alliance, which represents business interests along that corridor. What does having a strong North Temple mean to the neighborhoods, to the business owners in that area?
The business owners in the neighborhood have know that we are hand in hand. It's a partnership that strong community, strong residential, strong business makes for a good community. And part of it is that commercial on the North Temple Street.
How are businesses faring during what has been quite a lengthy construction period? Again, we are putting in a new tracks line along that corridor. How are the businesses doing?
You know, it's challenging. They took down. We have a great, beautiful, brand new bridge. They actually closed the bridge, the access. They had to reroute traffic to get into the city. It went from 24,000 traffic cars on the street to almost non-existent 20 minutes to get one block. It's been a challenge, and a number of the businesses have. We've had closures. We've had what goes with that type of major construction.
Frank Gray, did you foresee this kind of extended construction period? Has it been long? Give us maybe a little bit of the history of the project.
The answer, I'm sure, to any business or resident out there, it's been longer than they had hoped for. The project is actually way ahead of schedule. The bridge opened early, and the contractor on this job has been absolutely wonderful to deal with, both for the businesses and the community, and for the city and for UTA. And they have put full effort into getting this done early, trying to get it closed up, and ensuring that there is access and accessibility to the businesses along there. Yes, it's been very hard for the businesses. We've put together business mitigation loans that the businesses can apply for to try to help them bridge that gap. I think the environment when this is done is going to be so much better that all of them will all of them are tolerating and will appreciate eventually what's been done.
Speaking with Frank Gray, Salt Lake City's Director of Community and Economic Development, also Dave Galvan with the West Side Business Alliance. We're talking about the new North Temple Corridor. There is a public meeting being held tomorrow morning at the Grand Hall at the Utah Fair Park. More information on our website, kcpw.org. Frank Gray, the city is calling this the Grand Entrance to downtown. Describe the grand part. What can we expect when the dust settles, the construction cranes are gone? What's it going to look like?
This is a boulevard, an entry boulevard to the city, and it is being done different than other entries into the city in the fact that all modes of transportation are being provided for in this corridor from the ground up. So we will have light rail. We'll have bus, so we'll have the public transportation. We still will have automobiles on the street, but they will be going much slower than they have been in the past. There's bicycle and there's pedestrian facilities along the street and intensive landscaping in the major portion of the site.
A boulevard makes me think of strolling. I mean, are you hoping that this will be a very walkable area?
Yes, it's actually designed to be walkable. We think that the community will bike, they will walk, and they will get to the businesses that serve those communities. And around the transit stops themselves, there will be facilities and businesses that will serve the transit or the transit-oriented development.
So this is going all the way from the gateway all the way to the airport. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And so people coming from the airport, this will be their first introduction to what Salt Lake City is.
Right. And on the top of the bridge, the new viaduct, is the connector to the front runner. And so people will be coming from Davis County or from the south, from Provo, eventually, as that gets extended down there, coming to this line and going on out to the airport. So it's going to become a very, very desirable place to have your business, to have your office, and we're really excited about it.
I imagine that residents and businesses are pinning a lot of their hopes on the successful completion of this project. Dave Galvan, what are your expectations from this new beautified roadway?
No, I don't know that it's hopes, but what the community has looked at, exactly what Frank talked about, they wanted to be able to walk. What the city's investment and everybody's investment there is huge. I mean, the pedestrian sidewalks are going to be larger, the landscaping. It's just millions of dollars. But what the community thinks is that's what we've asked for, that's what we've wanted, and that's what other areas have seen help develop their economic base and provide the stimulus to have for businesses come in and be successful.
So you think this is key to revitalizing not just this roadway but the entire area?
I think there's a lot of things at play here. The Jordan River Parkway, Northwest Multipurpose Center, a brand new rec center, on and on and on. And the proximity to the Central Business District, this neighborhood, is just ripe for development, and that it is the time.
Dave Galvan mentioned the investment. So, Frank Gray, how much money is the city putting into this project? How much is UTA putting into this project?
My understanding, and I'm going to be general in these numbers, is that it's about a $300 million project for the light rail out there. The city has put in about $20 million through contributions from the state and the city. And the property owners themselves, the property owners have agreed to, at least a portion of the property owners have agreed to tax themselves to put in high-end lighting on the area and increased landscaping that will be maintained in a common way. Mm. So it's an investment by everybody.
Significant dollars. So what does this mean, the future of North Temple? What will it look like? We've heard a lot about transit-oriented development in which, you know, high-rise, a little denser housing is provided, more retail opportunities. Frank Gray, how do you see North Temple looking in 10, 20 years?
I think what you said was really important, in 10 to 20 years. I think that the development will happen slowly over time. We have to get it open first, and then people will start believing that it's really happening and it's really there. I think that you will see more dense development, especially around the station areas. You know, it doesn't give you a lot of benefit to be where the train doesn't stop. It's where it stops that you get a beneficial where it's beneficial for you. And so I think you'll start to see areas around the transit stops begin to really develop and intensify. And I think it's 5 to 15 years out before you start to see major development in the area. But yes, I think it will be a fairly dense corridor. You can look at other cities that have done this and where they've put their light rail, and you see that kind of development occurring. That's part of what we're doing in this development conference, is having experts come in who have done this elsewhere in the country and talk to the property owners and the real estate community about the opportunity and what they need to do to take advantage of it.
And Dave Galvan, as a business owner representing the West Side Business Alliance, as a longtime resident of that area, do you welcome that new image of North Temple?
We welcome, we've invited, we've supported, and we've lobbied for this to come.
So embracing the future. The public meeting is tomorrow. It is free and open to the public, Frank Gray?
It is. We've asked people to sign up. We have over 200 people that have signed up, but people should feel free to come if they haven't done that.
Frank Gray, he is Salt Lake City's Director of Community and Economic Development. Dave Galvan, he is a member of the West Side Business Alliance and a resident of the North Temple area. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and to Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Next time, the raging debate over mother-in-law apartments. Speaking of density, basement apartments, so-called accessory dwellings here in Salt Lake City. We'll hear more about Mayor Becker's push for higher density in the capital. Hope you'll join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.